And now, let's discuss it. Our Sunday evening program from the News and Community Affairs Departments of CFRB. Our guest this evening is Dr. Helen S. Hogg, renowned Canadian astronomer, lecturer, and writer. Our panelists are Gordon Sinclair, Betty Kennedy, and Torben Wittrup, with CFRB's Director of Community Affairs, Arthur Cole, as moderator. Will the Viking probe, now preparing to land on Mars, establish the possibility of life on that planet? Ladies and gentlemen, let's discuss it.
Dr. Hogg, welcome. Your new book, The Stars Belong to Everyone, published by Doubleday, has been described as an illuminating summation of the state of your art, which is astronomy. Coming as it does when our celestial horizons are expanding by leaps and bounds, it's most timely. What do you think Viking 2, which will now land sometime around July the 20th on Mars, will uncover?
Well, I think the most important thing it may uncover is whether or not there is or has been life there. And I certainly couldn't hazard a guess at this point how that will come out.
Well, you have seen some of the photographs which have come already.
Yes.
Do they indicate anything to you in the way of moisture on Mars?
Oh, yes. The earlier ones were quite a surprise in showing what looked like deep river channels. This was not expected, especially after the analysis of the moon rocks showed that not merely is there no water on the moon now, but there never has been any there. But the Martian photographs really looked to have water in the past. Some suggestions were as recently as 10,000 years ago.
There are indications, too, that there is water in the atmosphere even now.
A bit, yes. Mm-hmm. The polar caps evaporate, and there may be some water there, as well as carbon dioxide snow. There's carbon dioxide there, too.
How valuable were the moon landing?
Oh, exceedingly, Betty. They are showing a lot of the back history of the moon. They're very, very old. The moon dust goes back about 4.6 billion years. The moon rocks, I understand, are a bit newer than that, say 4.2 or 3. But they trace the past history of the moon for the regions that they were taken from. They're invaluable.
When you talk in terms of billions of years, that just boggles the mind, really.
Well, the Earth is that many years old, so we sort of have to get used to the idea.
How does that fit into the theory of the first chapter of the Bible?
Well, I think it is up to the clergy and the philosophers to interpret the Bible in terms of the scientific findings rather than the scientists interpreting it, don't you?
I really don't know. I can't imagine a world being created in 7 days, but then I'm a storyteller like the people who wrote the Bible.
Yes.
So I don't understand. In your study of the stars and the great spaces and the great distances and the great ages, does this have a belittling or humbling effect upon you personally?
No, I think perhaps the opposite, because we here on Earth are able to look to incredible distances, photograph objects out to 10,000 million light years, and our brains can really understand what they are. Not everything, of course, but a lot about it. And I think that says a great deal for the human race. And we're learning more all the time.
Do you do work out of the Dunlap Observatory?
Yes. That's where I've worked for 41 years.
Well, you helped to build it, didn't you?
No. I came after it was built.
Oh.
My husband and I came just the year it was opened.
Does metro pollution, is it interfering with observations out there yet?
The light interferes with my program. And my plates are now being taken with the U of T telescope in Chile for my program. But the spectrographic part, which has been really the main part of the observatory's program, still goes on. When the light is put through a spectrograph, the fact that there's a lot of other skylight around doesn't matter so much.
So it'll still be used for quite some time.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Radio astronomy is not going to replace the optical astronomy.
No, it supplements it. Mm-hmm.
Many people don't know a great deal about this subject, but everybody has looked at stars on their out in a country night where mm-hmm. everything is so much more visible and so much more clear and sharp. Why is it that the stars seem to twinkle or wink or flash or whatever it is?
Well, that's irregularity in the atmosphere, and the winking does not please astronomers at all. And this is why observatories nowadays are being put up on very high mountaintops. They were years ago, too. But in the last couple of decades, there's been much more of a site selection program, and observatories are being put literally thousands of miles away from the people who are working with them, such as the observatories in Chile and the new Canada-France-Hawaii telescope on Mauna Kea in Hawaii. That's going to be at nearly 14,000 feet, and there won't be very much twinkling of stars at that altitude because you're above so much of the atmosphere.
So they're not winking or twinkling. There isn't a pulse to the light at all.
There are two things here, Betty. One is that the Earth's atmosphere makes the stars seem to twinkle. Another thing, and this is what interests astronomers, the stars themselves can fade in light and brighten, and this is their own doing. This is independent of the atmosphere. And sometimes they fade because a dark star, there are two stars going around a common center of gravity, and a dark star cuts off the light of a bright one, and that goes into eclipse and its light diminishes. And sometimes they fade because they're pulsating in and out and brighten and fade down again.
This pulsating and so on, does that suggest that this Earth could collide with some other heavenly body?
Oh, no, not at all.
You see no prospect of that at all?
Oh, none at all.
Why can stars only be seen at night?
Because the sky brightness from the sun is so great. Now, out in space, they can be seen in the daytime because the sunlight is not being scattered around. And a lovely thing about the planned big LST, the Large Space Telescope, is that it can work, I believe, at 6,000 hours a year because it will be away from the atmosphere and the skylight isn't scattered around.
Speaking of these very costly instruments, do they offer any suggestion for practical use of solar energy? In other words, you could concentrate one sunbeam, if there is such a word as beam, onto something and make enormous heat.
Yes.
Does that have a practical use in solar energy?
Yes, there's a specialized development in this direction. There have been for many years a huge solar collecting telescope in France. France has been quite in the forefront here. There have been other ones in the southwestern United States, and 25 or so years ago I was taken to the roof of the California Institute of Technology and shown their specialized solar collector telescope. And this is all research toward the way of utilizing solar energy.
Do you think we'll ever have a telescope on Mars or on the moon, say? Maybe the moon would be better.
Well, some years ago it was proposed that the moon would be the ideal site for a telescope. And then the idea was switched to one in orbit, the Large Space Telescope. And the advantage there is that it's practically as good as having it on the moon. It's a couple of 100,000 miles nearer, and the astronauts who are going to the space platform can do the necessary repairs or adjustments or this and that. It would be much more difficult for them to do it on the moon.
But being on a moving platform surely would make your calculations much more difficult, wouldn't it?
No, I don't think so, because the whole thing, we're on a moving Earth now, you see. And
we
always tend to forget
platform.
That. Yes.
You can actually see it in her observatory, can't you?
Yes.
You can stand there and watch a movement. I've done it.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Well, will there be any kind of laboratory established on the moon? Do you think that that'll come someday?
I haven't heard any plans along that line now. About 20 years ago, when it began to look as though the space program would really materialize, the moon was talked about as a location of a telescope. I haven't heard it recently. What I've read has been all these platforms in space rather than going as far as the moon.
Now, the inevitable question about astrologers, who, in my opinion, are fakes and frauds and swindlers. Really? What is your opinion?
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that.
Well, I guess that settles that subject.
Dr. Hogg, in your book, you mentioned a great many things that are of keen interest to just average people who haven't studied astrology at all. One of the things that intrigued me was that you say the sun is still visible after it's actually set below the horizon.
You got caught on your own one there, yes. You said astrology.
Astronomy, yeah.
Yes. How
can you still see the sun after it has actually set below the horizon?
That's a simple matter of refraction. Have you noticed spoons and glasses of water or sticks at the edge of the lake? They don't look straight when they're in the water. There's a bend. Mm. Well, refraction is the greatest right at the horizon. It's half a degree that it seems to lift things up. And the apparent angular diameter of both the sun and the moon is half a degree. And so that means that they are, when they've got down below the horizon, they're just lifted apparently up above it. You wouldn't have that effect on the moon for the Earth because there's no refraction with no atmosphere there.
How many degrees would the diameter of the sun be at that point?
A degree. It's the apparent angular diameter of the sun and of the moon is a half a degree wherever they are in the sky.
You mentioned the space program and when it looked as though finally the space program was going to become a reality, and it made me think that just in your lifetime you've seen an enormous number of advances in your particular field. What would you rate as the most dazzling or the most remarkable?
Well, that's hard because there have been so many, but probably the moon. Those pictures that came first from the Soviet probes on the back, the rear side of the moon, I never expected that we here on Earth would know what the rear side of the moon looks like. It's forever invisible from Earth. And then when we saw the astronauts actually landing on the moon, incredible.
It beats science fiction, doesn't it? It must get harder and harder to write science fiction.
Well, I would think so.
How long do you think our solar system will last?
Well, I can't give you to the exact 1,000,000,000, but it's in the thousands of millions of years.
Nothing to worry about. Won't be this weekend.
Mercury and Venus are probably going to get terribly hot. They're very hot now, but they'll get worse because the sun will heat up and get bigger as it goes along in its own path of stellar evolution.
Will it eventually burn out the Earth?
Probably not, but it will make the Earth hot enough so that maybe Mars will look as a better place to be. It could burn out Mercury.
So these stories that we may be heading into a new ice age are by you improbable?
No, because of the time scale here. The ice age time scale is centuries of thousands of years. The burning out of Mercury is thousands of millions of years, you say.
So we could have an ice age?
Yes, indeed we could.
Do you predict one?
No. But I think it's nice to know all we can about what our sunspot cycle, our solar cycle, is doing.
Well, the people who do make such predictions of a coming ice age, do you have respect for their opinions?
Yes.
Yeah, they are doing what they think is the proper thing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. When you talk of the moon as having been one of the major achievements that you have lived to see, what would you think would be the next major one of that caliber or that standing? What's the logical one?
The the pictures from the planets, probably, but here we're in solar system. There have been amazing discoveries out deep in space, like the quasars and the pulsars and the Crab Nebula, that these are things on a gigantic scale that we didn't know about 50 years ago. So it's hard. It's like comparing apples and oranges.
Dr. Hagen panel, we'll take a short break now. We'll be back with Let's Discuss It in just a moment. This is Arthur Cole with Let's Discuss It, and our guest is the Canadian astronomer, Dr. Helen Hogg. Betty Kennedy, you have another question?
Yes, you've expressed skepticism about flying saucers. Is there something in terms of your field that would explain flying saucers in a logical way?
Well, I think I'm skeptical about many of the reports. I certainly don't take a stand that there couldn't be a spaceship come from beyond the Earth. I myself and most of the astronomers I know have never seen such evidence. There is a small residual. You get all kinds of flying saucer reports. Most of them you can track down and say, oh, this was the planet Venus, or this was that and the other. There's a small residual, I call it the tail end, that is not well explained. To me, the explanation does not lie in a spaceship coming from beyond the Earth yet. There's no reason, I think, why one couldn't come sometime. But when it does, there seems to me there'll be many, many observations of it by many people, and it will be a documented happening.
You think that we might more likely receive a signal from by radio or some other?
I think that's more likely, yes. And astronomers are now using some of the biggest radio telescopes to listen for such signals coded in from space.
Are we doing any work like that in Canada at our radio observatory?
I'm not sure whether time on any of our instruments is used for that or not. Time at Arecibo, the 1,000-foot is, I think, and there's been considerable time from Green Bank, and there are Soviet astronomers that are doing things along this line, too. It's something that, of course, you can keep on, well, probably for centuries, just listening and hoping.
Meteorites, that's something we do know something about.
Oh, absolutely.
I've even seen some you have, I guess most of us have. What is the biggest known meteorite?
The biggest single one is the Hobo West near Grootfontein in southern Africa. And that's not been weighed. It's still right on the veldt where it fell. The biggest in what you would call captivity is the Anagito, which Captain Robert Peary brought back from Greenland after several expeditions just to get it. Oh my, what he went through to get that. And that's in the Hayden Planetarium. They built a special scale to weigh it.
And how much does it weigh?
36 tons, I think, 34. That's,
and he brought that back from Greenland.
Yes, He helped the Eskimos helped him load it. It was the subject of several expeditions up to get it, and there were three meteorites there. The Anagito was the biggest, and then there was the woman and the dog, each of which weighed several thousand pounds, and the Eskimos had been working these for iron. They had iron knives that they had got from these meteorites.
Hmm.
Well, now, where do they come from? Where do meteorites come from?
These are absolutely, unequivocally, from beyond the Earth. The chemical composition is like no rock on Earth. And they've been seen, not the particular ones we were talking about, the Greenland ones, but many have been actually seen to come down by hundreds or even thousands of people. They come mainly, we think, from the so-called asteroid belt, which is between Mars and Jupiter, in orbit between Mars and Jupiter, and there are thousands of fragments of rocks. The biggest of the asteroids, which are around 300 to 500 miles across several of the biggest. And they get down to the sizes of just little boulders. And some of these get on a very elongated orbit that comes in crossing the Earth's orbit. And if it crosses at the same time that the Earth is there, bang, we get it.
Well, this meteorites, I believe, were considered to be a possible hazard for the astronauts.
Yes.
And yet, apparently, they had little or no trouble with those. Do you think this was just luck, or could it be a problem with space vehicles?
I'm not sure that they yet know, really, the density of these things out in space. There were meteorite bumpers. They were worrying about just small meteorites, too, and they can sort of protect for those, I believe. If they encountered a big rock in space, it would be serious.
Well, is a meteorite quite different from a shooting star?
They're related, Betty, in this way, that tiny little pieces of material, size of a pinhead, can be a shooting star. Anything as big as a meteorite that comes down to Earth is a fireball when we see it, and much brighter than the, you'd compare it maybe even with the moon in brightness as it sails across the sky.
Your book mentions that there's no sound on the sun, total silence.
On the
Why
moon,
would that
moon,
be?
Moon,
on the moon, yes, I mean the moon.
Because there's no atmosphere there. And you need an atmosphere to carry sound waves, you see.
Oh.
Will there be a need for men to do work on Mars, or can it all be done by machines? Would the ideal situation be to have eventually some astronauts walking around on the surface?
I think perhaps when we get the results from the Mariner, we can answer that one better. It's a long way to go to Mars and back.
The Viking.
The Viking, I mean,
yes. How long
would
it take?
Well, that Viking has been on its way nearly a year. And then you presumably want to bring the people back. That's a long pull. Much, much longer, you see, than the moon.
Dr. Hogg, something we're all familiar with in this part of the world anyway is Aurora Borealis, or commonly known as the Northern Lights. What causes this, and is it really confined to northern regions?
It's more frequent in our northern regions. We're favored here in Canada. The closer you go toward the tropics, the fewer aurora you see. And the explanation is fairly simple. It's caused by high energy particles being shot out from the sun. We have a thing called the solar wind, which wasn't known very much a couple of decades ago, that these high energy particles impinge in the Earth's atmosphere, and it's sort of like a neon sign. And one explanation that dies very hard, and it was given me several weeks ago when I was up in the Yukon Territory, I heard it again, that the aurora is caused by the sunlight reflected from the icebergs.
Well, that's the one I certainly heard.
Yes, somebody must have taught that in school years ago. Well, it isn't. We have more up-to-date knowledge now.
What made you choose astronomy, and are there many other women in it? I don't happen to know of any others, but I don't know whether you are unique or not.
Oh, no, I'm not unique by a long shot. There aren't as many women as I wish there were. Not more than about 10% on this continent of the astronomers are women. The proportion is higher in the Soviet Union.
And while we're on personal subjects, how long have you been a widow, and why didn't you remarry?
Well, I've been a widow 25 years, and I've been working very hard ever since. It's something I love to do, bringing up my children and working with the telescope and lecturing and writing and all sorts of things.
And so no time for men.
Do you think that man will ever be able to alter the atmospheres of planets like Venus or Mars to make them Earth-like?
Oh, I think that's too big a proposition for the immediate, foreseeable future. Mm. Ever? Oh, gracious. What would you do with that terrifically high surface temperature of Venus if you started altering the atmosphere. It's about 800 to 900 degrees. That would be something you'd want to alter too.
It has been suggested that if you seed it, if the clouds were seeded on Venus with certain bacteria, that a breakdown could occur in the atmosphere that would eventually reverse the cloud formations and make the surface more palatable to the human being.
Cool it off. And cool it down to below boiling water.
And produce water on the surface, apparently. Not too much of it, but enough to coat it with a 1 mile deep surface, apparently, in some areas.
Did some reputable scientist
Well, Dr. Seguin has said that.
Has he said that?
He suggested.
It sounds like a pretty big proposition to me.
I'm sure it will.
You never sound baffled or astounded by anything. Does anything surprise you?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
When you mention those degrees of that particular planet, what is the heat of the sun?
Well, the sun's surface is around 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. The interior is in millions, 16, 18 millions, making energy. You see, the sun is losing a terrific amount of its mass every second to send it out in the form of radiation.
But the sun is not solid mass, is it?
No, but the density would be high in the center with all the weight of the overlaying.
Dr. Hogg, we all know that living creatures evolved on the Earth. What we don't know for certain is that evolution produced a rational creature of its own accord. Is there any scientific proof that this is the way man evolved?
Of evolution?
Yes.
Well,
or was it a divine doing?
I think this comes in the field of paleontology and microbiology and things like that, more than astronomy, really. But astronomers are finding giant molecules in space that give an indication that they might evolve into, some lower forms of life, perhaps.
Do you think that the mere mathematics of the universe indicate that there must be some kind of extraterrestrial life out there?
I think it's very probable that there is. I'm not sure that I'd use the word must, but I think it's very, very probable that there is other life elsewhere. If not in our solar system, then out amongst some of the literally thousands of millions of planets that must be attending the stars we can see out there.
One of the things that strikes, you know, someone like myself who knows really very little about this field is the enormous sense of order there must be in this. I don't know how all these things are flying around out there without utter chaos.
The universe is just so beautiful from beginning to end, it seems to me. And I hope more people will take time to read about it and understand a bit what's out there.
Can you tell me what a black hole is?
Well, a black hole is a region into which a great deal of matter has fallen or condensed or something, and the matter has lost all its individuality. And nothing escapes from it, but you can detect it by its gravitational pull on, say, a nearby star.
Is it in fact a big star that has collapsed in on itself?
It could be the end product of a big star, yes.
As a final question, or nearly final question, you've frequently mentioned mathematics, and mathematics is certainly a part of your science. How did they manage this before computers?
Actually, they couldn't find out many of these things before the giant computers came in. It's fortunate they came with the space age. I don't know how they'd ever have kept track of the satellites. I don't think they could. And the business of the constitutional makeup of a star, those equations all go into the giant computers. They would be almost hopeless without them.
Well, thank you, Dr. Hogg and panel. Despite all this talk of light years of time and space, which is almost beyond human comprehension, We are limited to 30 minutes, so we'll have to close now. Dr. Hogg, best wishes for your success in this new book.
This has been Let's Discuss It, our regular program from the News and Community Affairs Departments of CFRB. Our guest was Dr. Helen Sawyer Hogg, author of a new book, The Stars Belong to Everyone, by Doubleday. Our panelists were Gordon Sinkler, Betty Kennedy, and Torben Wittrup, with Arthur Cole as moderator. We invite you to listen again next Sunday at 6:10 for another in the Let's Discuss It series. This is CFRB Toronto 1010 on your dial, Ontario's authoritative news voice.